Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Here's a song from a longtime Corona Queens resident. Here's Louis Armstrong.
I went it in. Ain't got a friend. My only sin is in my skin. What did I do to be so black and blue?
That's Black and Blue, originally composed by Fats Waller and later performed by Satchmo. The song is the basis for the title of a new documentary about Armstrong, which explores many facets of the musician's life and career, including experience as a black man, whose rise to fame began only 60 years after slavery ended and still 30 years before the civil rights movement coalesced, the modern civil rights movement. As the film explains, his early career was spent playing in clubs like Harlem's Connie's Inn, which invited black performers but restricted their audience to whites only. Yet in time, Armstrong was able to put in his contract that he wouldn't play places where he couldn't stay. He was also the first black host of a national radio show on a major network. In his film career, he became the first black performer to get above title billing. You can see the film Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues on Apple TV Plus. Joining us now are its director, Sasha Jenkins. Sasha, nice to see you.
Nice to be here.
And Ricky Riccardi, the director of research collections at the Louis Armstrong House Museum in Queens, who served as a consulting producer on the film. Welcome back, Ricky.
Thank you.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you have a story or a connection to Louis Armstrong? What has his music meant to you? Call in with your comments and maybe even questions. 212-433-WNYC. That is 212-433-9692. 212-433-WNYC. Social media is at All of It WNYC. Sasha, when did you become interested in making a film about Louis Armstrong?
Well, the nice people at Imagine Entertainment gave me a call. I wasn't really thinking about it. Huh. And, growing up in Queens myself, I knew that there was a school named after him and I knew he had lived in Queens for a time, but it wasn't at the front of my mind. But when I got the phone call and I did a little bit of research, I was completely blown away by who the man was.
And you do, you know, I think a lot of folks know your work in hip hop. You co-founded the hip hop magazine Ego Trip. Were you able to connect your interest and your scholarship around hip hop to the work of Louis Armstrong?
Totally. I mean, that question has come up, but you know, I've done lots of hip hop things, but we're dealing with black music in America. Mm-hmm. And so when I did the research and I learned more about him, I mean, you know, he's catching a gun charge at 14. I mean, look at where we are in the inner cities of New York City with guns mm-hmm. at the moment. So Armstrong has more in common with RZA than you would think. And, you know, Nas is a friend. And when I told him that I was making this film, he said, "Wonderful World" is my favorite song in the world. And I said, "Well, you've got to be the voice." And so for me, you know, coming from the inner cities in Queens, you know, knowing that there are so many talented, creative people who don't have a shot, but there's always one person who makes it out. And for us in Astoria and in Queensbridge, Nas was our Louis Armstrong, so it all was full circle for me.
Ricky, you've been involved in telling Louis Armstrong's story for many years and consulted on many projects. What does this film add to the way we think about Louis Armstrong? What's a fresh perspective we get?
Well, we finally get to hear Louis in his own voice. There's been some, obviously, many books about Armstrong. There's been other attempts at documentaries, but this is the first time that he's really in charge of the story. And the timing of it couldn't be any better because I'm actually getting deja vu right now because it was 4 years ago this week that I was on this show to talk about the digitization of the Louis Armstrong archives. We had just received a $2.7 million grant from Robert F. Smith's Fund to Foundation to digitize the entire archives. And I remember talking on that show about what this was going to do. You know, people would have access and there'd be more scholarship and more information, not knowing at the time that this was coming down the pike. And I think this is really the first project, and I think it might be the first of many, where Sasha and his entire crew, I mean, this was made during a global pandemic. You know, I was able to provide them tape, scrapbook pages, manuscripts, photographs, anything. You know, we were in constant contact via email. And to take those digitized assets and now have a film where Lewis is basically the main talking head and you get to hear him in every kind of light, it just shows you the power of digitization. And it's the right film for the right time in the moment.
And Sasha, when you're thinking about the film and you're thinking about the way the film looks, I know we're on radio, but it has a very specific look and a very specific style. And you make some really interesting choices with graphics and pulling. There's a certain sort of scrapbook collage sort of looking ethos to it. I'm curious how you came to that idea of pulling out pieces of scrapbook, of having text come across the screen so that we can not only hear Louis Armstrong, but we can also read his words.
Well, Mr. Armstrong was a scrapbooker. He, you know, kept detailed information on articles and news clippings and stuff about his work and his life. But in addition to that, he just made this really wonderful collage art, which I didn't know anything about, which, you know, he made for himself to entertain himself. He wasn't exhibiting in galleries. Mm-hmm. So to me, we wanted to mimic or sort of pay tribute to that style because it gives you more information on who he was and more of his fingerprint by sort of replicating that. So you'll see his actual collage work in the film, and then you'll see what we've done support that.
It's really cool looking. Let's talk to Jeff calling in from Ocean Grove, New Jersey. Hi, Jeff. You are on the air.
Hi. How you doing? So, yeah, my story is amazing, and I have documentation. I have a signed program from him. It said, keep blowing, Satchmo, to Jeffrey, keep blowing. So it was around my 10th birthday. My father was a jazz aficionado and my uncle, and he played sax. And they used to follow Armstrong wherever he was in the New York, New Jersey area and got to know him because Satchmo used to hang out afterwards, and he was very approachable. So I had started to play trumpet because of that in fourth grade. So I guess I was around 9 or 10. And then there was a show at the Paper Mill Playhouse in Millburn, New Jersey. And my father and I went. And when it was over, he said, do you want to meet him? And I said, huh? So we did. We went backstage. There's a long, skinny dressing room. And he was sitting at a makeup mirror, sweating like crazy with a white bandana around his forehead. And he saw my father and he goes, hey, Witty. That's my father, Bill. And I sat on his lap for probably 20 minutes or a half an hour where they chewed the fat. And I just kept staring at his face, which is 2 inches away from me. And near the end of the time that we were back there, he said, you want to play my trumpet? And I was, huh? So he took me to the back of the room and the trumpet case was open. And it had a gold-plated mouthpiece, and I picked it up, and I tooted a few notes, and he just was roaring in laughter, so happy. So
that's
isn't that amazing or what?
It's amazing and or what? It's both. Ricky, you were sort of smiling and laughing during Jeff's call. Does this track for you that Louis Armstrong would do this? How does this track?
Oh, I mean, we at the Louis Armstrong House Museum, and we have people who come in all the time who either met him or had a brief moment with him, similar to Jeff's. I, in the writing of my books, I've interviewed every surviving musician and friends and all that stuff, and it completely tracks. You know, if he met you for the first time, he made you feel like he had known you his entire life. And I once compared notes with the late Terry Teachout, who also wrote a book on Armstrong. And we said, everybody that he had talked to and everybody I had talked to, anybody who spent a moment in his presence, nobody had a bad word mm-hmm. to say about him. And that's almost impossible to find. You know, you can find the critics, of course, and things like that. But if people were in that position that Jeff was in that dressing room for a moment, they felt like family.
Sasha, as you were thinking about people you wanted to include in the documentary, voices that you wanted to hear to tell this story, how did you decide who you wanted to hear and share with our audience maybe a voice that they might not expect that they would hear in the documentary? We hear from Wynton Marsalis, expect that a little bit. What tell us a little bit about your choices and an unusual voice.
Well, I don't know about if there's any unusual voices outside of Nas, people feeling mm-hmm. like, wow, that's an interesting choice to do some to be the voice of Armstrong, reading some letters and things. But, you know, the idea was to use people, voices that knew him in the moment, who were there, not to have a bunch of contemporary talking heads. I mean, of course, we have Marsalis and we have Dan Morgenstern, who is, you know, a journalist who knew Armstrong and has written about him extensively. But for the most part, it's a lot of archival speaking to Armstrong, because it just, when you have the voice of the man himself, it didn't feel right to take you out of the moment of being with him. And I think because we cut the film the way we did, by the time you get to the end of the film and you know what's going to happen, but you feel the sense of loss because you've gone on this ride with this guy that you didn't know in the beginning, but you feel like you know him a bit. So we chose folks who really knew him at the time, not latter day folks.
My guests are Sasha Jenkins and Ricky Ricardo. We are talking about the film Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues on Apple TV Plus. We'll have more after a quick break. This is All of It. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. My guests this hour are director Sasha Jenkins. The name of the film is Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues on Apple TV Plus. Also joining us is Ricky Riccardi, consulting producer and director of research collections for the Louis Armstrong House Museum here in New York City. So Sasha, the documentary's name is a nod to race, obviously, and the film really illuminates how race affected Mr. Armstrong in his career, in his life, times he got involved with civil rights, times he didn't. How did Louis Armstrong talk about race in public versus how he talked about it in private?
He really didn't talk about it in public, but you have to think about the time from which he came. Born in 1901 in New Orleans. I mean, that's about a heartbeat away from slavery in the South. By the time of civil rights, a lot of younger folks were criticizing him, saying that he wasn't doing enough, if anything at all. But you have to consider the fact that if Louis Armstrong was a member of the Black Panther Party in 1933, Louis Armstrong wouldn't have happened. America wouldn't have allowed it. So he had to do this tactical and emotional spiritual jujitsu to navigate what was being thrown at, what America had to throw at him.
I want to play a clip from the film Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues. The features the legendary actor Ossie Davis. He is talking here about an experience on set with Mr. Armstrong. This is from Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues.
And I went back on the set to lie down on the bed. And there was Louis by the door, sitting in a chair, staring up and out into space with the saddest, most heartbreaking expression I've ever seen on a man's face. I just stared at him for a moment. And then when I tried to turn and sneak away, the noise snapped Louis out of it. And all of a sudden, there was that professional grin again. Mouth wide open, he whipped out his handkerchief, mopped his brow. Hey, Pops, look like you cats trying to starve old Louis to death. Yeah. I put on my face and grinned right back. But it wasn't funny. Not anymore. What I saw in that look shook me. It was my father, my uncle, myself, down through the generations, doing exactly what Louis had to do for the same reason, to survive.
Ricky, how did Mr. Armstrong maintain both his dignity and his composure through all of the discrimination he faced? He was right smack in the middle of the worst years.
I wish I knew. I wish I had a concrete answer. Part of it, I think, goes back to his childhood, because you have to consider what he grew up in New Orleans, the level of poverty, the level of crime, the level of police brutality. He's quitting school. His mother's a prostitute. He's out there hustling. He's stealing. He's getting arrested for being a dangerous and suspicious character. Him and his sister are cutting the spoiled parts of food out of garbage cans so they could eat that night. Didn't have a pair of shoes till he was a teenager. So that's childhood. Mm. And then he, you know, for the rest of his life, he was asked, you know, what was the greatest moment of his life? And he always said, coming up to Chicago and joining King Oliver. And so I think that moment, which was 100 years ago this summer, in July 1922, Armstrong was able to become a professional musician. He was able to conquer the big city. He was playing with his mentor slash father figure and changing the world. Everything else that happened after that was gravy. And so even in his lowest moments, he could go back. There's a Mike Douglas show from 1970 where he does a duet with Sherry Lewis and Lamb Chop. It's one of the most ridiculous things you'll ever see. It's hilarious. And at the end, Sherry Lewis asks him, how do you do that? Scat singing and all that kind of stuff. And he says, oh, if you get hungry, you'll do it. Hmm. And I always thought that line explains everything. He was hungry once. And, you know, so he had to take a lot. He had to take a lot from jazz critics. He had to take a lot from his own people. He had to take a lot from his fellow musicians. He had to take a lot on the road. You know, the movie is filled with stories of just the discrimination he faced on a nightly basis. Yet he was no longer hungry. I'll tell you one more quick story, because Armstrong's good friend Jack Bradley told something. He used to cry every time he told it, that in 1967, they were in a motel room in Framingham, Massachusetts, and Jack said that Lewis had tears in his eyes. And he said, you know, Jack, I've really made it. And Jack kind of laughed. He's like, this is the height of Hello, Dolly. He's like, what do you mean? Of course you've made it. And Lewis pointed out a little mini fridge in the motel room and said, you see that refrigerator over there? Anytime I'm hungry, I can go over, open it, and make myself some eggs. And that's how I know I've made it. And so he never lost that, you know, that, you know, in the film, Lucille calls him the man on the street. You know, he loved to be among the people. When you go to his house in Corona, Queens, you see that. That's where he chose to live, the people he surrounded himself with. Mm-hmm. He never let fame or money or anything get to his head. And he never let any of it steal the joy he got from performing. Every night on stage was a gift to him, and he wasn't going to let anybody take that away.
Let's take some more calls. Let's go to Laura calling from Oyster Bay. Hi, Laura. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. I'm actually calling for my husband, who is the songwriter Jimmy Webb, and he tells a beautiful story almost every show when he's on stage about the impact, the positive impact Louis Armstrong had on his career as a young writer in Motown. He was 17, 18 years old. He was sent to Las Vegas to present some songs to some other singers, and he was in the break room. It was dimly lit. Somebody was sleeping. Jimmy Webb was reading his music, getting ready to share it, and the man who was taking a nap woke up and said, let me see what you've got there, kid. And he read my husband's music, and Jimmy saw in the light, when he turned the little desk lamp on, he saw in the light the round circle around the lips and was like, oh my God, that's Louis Armstrong. And he said Louis read his music, which happened to be the song By the Time I Get to Phoenix, had nobody had recorded it yet. And Louis said, stick with it, kid. And they called him to the stage. He was doing 8 shows a day in Vegas at that point. He leaves the room. He comes back in and he says, kid, stick with it. And Jimmy said that he has called on that memory so many times in his career when he thought maybe he would do something else. And he would say, Louis told me to stick with it. And he went on to write MacArthur Park, Wichita Lineman, Galveston, Worst That Could Happen, many, many other hits. And it just makes me sad that he had some hard times, Louis Armstrong, because he meant so much to my husband.
Laura, what a fantastic story. Thank you for sharing that. That's amazing. Let's talk to Nora from White Plains, New York, who has a very good and interesting association with Louis Armstrong. Hi, Nora. Thanks for calling All of It. I mean, Dandy.
Hey, how's it going, Allison?
Good. Go for it.
Good. Long time listener, first time caller. So I'm a band leader here in New York City, from Harlem originally, and Louis Armstrong is such an important figure to me, and really is one of the reasons why I do what I do, focusing on early jazz from the 1920s, 30s, and a little bit beyond. But I have a framed painting of Louis Armstrong that was given to me by Brent Napoleon, who is the grandson of Marty Napoleon, a pianist who worked with Louis Armstrong. And it's it's a painting of Louis playing on black velvet, and it's an incredible thing, and I look at it every day, and it you know, continues to speak to me. And you know, just even to touch on the conversation on hip hop for a moment, you hear Mahogany Hall Stomp, the beginning of that, buck, 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 man, that's hip hop right there. It's there.
Dan, so. Love it. Dandy, thank you so much for calling in. We are talking about Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues. It's on Apple TV Plus. I'm speaking with director Sasha Jenkins, as well as Ricky Riccardi, who is a consulting producer. Sasha, I don't want to make people feel like the film is dark and full of despair. There are some great laughs in the film. You get a sense of Louis Armstrong's sense of humor in the film. And we love the part that made me laugh was the part when he starts talking about his like of herbs. Right. How much he liked marijuana. Why was that important to fold into the film?
Well, his love of marijuana and also his love of laxatives, which I think is an interesting factoid. But mm-hmm. I mean, you just want to know. I think knowing the random things about people really gives you a window into who they really were. I mean, marijuana is not really random. It's, you know, look at where we are now. He was so ahead of the curve and so with it that's what makes the story so contemporary, because a lot of the things that we explore in the film, things haven't changed. I mean, things have changed for marijuana, but race and police brutality and so many other things haven't changed.
Ricky, before we go, the House Museum's opening a new center in 2023. You want to give us the elevator pitch?
Yeah, no, it's exciting times. I know you had Jason Moran on yesterday. Jason actually curated the permanent exhibit that's going to be featured in the new center. And it's going to be opening up, we're hoping, looking like spring 2023, directly across the street from the house, the Louis Armstrong Center. It's a $24 million project, been decades in the making, but it's going to be the new home of the archives. The archives are going to move from Queens College to the new facility. And then, as I mentioned, a permanent exhibit curated by Jason, interactive experiences, a 70-seat performance room, a gift shop. And so you'll be able to visit the Louis Armstrong mm-hmm. Center, walk across the street, see the Louis Armstrong house, maybe catch a concert, catch a lecture, catch a film screening. And it'll be our little version of Graceland right there in Corona, Queens.
The film is called Louis Armstrong's Black and Blues. You can and should watch it now on Apple TV Plus. I've been speaking with its director, Sasha Jenkins. Sasha, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Ricky Riccardi, consulting producer and director of research collections at the Louis Armstrong House Museum. Talk to you again soon, Ricky.
I'll be back.
And because we are on the edge of Thanksgiving, let's go out on Louis Armstrong with Thankful.
I'm thankful because you care. I'm thankful for dreams we share. When you came along, I was born anew. That's why I'm thankful to you. Oh, I'm thankful for happy hours. I'm thankful to all the flowers that smiles up at us from underneath the dew. Darling, I'm thankful to you. You seem so far above me. Each time you said you love me, a rainbow shoots across the sky. I've made quite a catch, and though I'm not your match.
And that is all of it for today. I'm Allison Stewart. I appreciate you. I appreciate your listening. And we here at All of It are thankful for your support. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Like this sense of bound love that only comes to view. Darling, I'm thankful to you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.